I was looking at the title of the document we're diving into today, and I have to admit, my first instinct was to grab a strong coffee.
I can see why.
Strategic digital media optimization. This feels so, I don't know, clinical.
It does. It has that corporate handbook vibe to it, doesn't it? But honestly, that's kind of the point.
How so? What do you mean?
Well, we spend so much time in this industry talking about the art of digital media, viral trends, creativity, the algorithm.
The magic of it all.
Exactly, the magic. But we rarely talk about the actual competence that's required to execute it professionally. This document, it's not a guide on how to be creative, it's a competency framework.
Oh, okay.
It's the baseline standard for someone whose job is actually to deliver results, not just, get likes.
So if I'm looking to hire a digital marketing lead, or if, you listening want to be that lead, this is basically the checklist. This is the can you actually do the job test?
Precisely. It breaks the whole role down into this really rigorous life cycle. Preparing, then optimizing, and then evaluating. And I think it clears up a big misconception I see all the time,
Oh, yeah.
which is that digital media is just posting stuff.
Right.
This framework makes it so clear that posting is what, maybe 10% of the job? The rest of it is all analysis, modeling, testing, data moderation.
Well, let's get into that other 90% then. The framework kicks off with phase one, the setup, or as the text puts it, prepare to promote digital media. Now, usually when people start a project, they jump straight to, okay, what are we going to make? But this standard just puts the brakes on that immediately.
Right. Before you even think about opening Photoshop or drafting a tweet, the very first requirement is to identify measurable impact objectives. And measurable is really the key word there.
We hear that all the time, though. Make it measurable. But what does this framework actually require? Is it just about setting a KPI and calling it a day?
It's a bit deeper than that. It's about aligning that objective with a real organizational need. But the part that really caught my eye in this section is the requirement to analyze existing online and offline channel data.
I wanted to ask you about that. We're talking about digital media optimization. Why is the standard forcing us to look at offline data? It feels inefficient.
It seems counterintuitive, I know.
Yeah. If I'm running a purely digital campaign, say for a SaaS product or an app, why do I care about offline metrics?
Because your user doesn't live in a vacuum. Even for a purely digital product, there are always offline touch points. I mean, think about customer support calls. That's offline data.
Okay, so like a call center log or something.
Exactly. So let's say you're analyzing your digital channels and everything looks great. Click-through rates are high, engagement's good.
All green.
Right. But then you look at the offline data, the call center logs, and you suddenly see a 40% spike in complaints about one specific feature being confusing.
Ah, so you have a content gap.
You have a massive content gap. Your marketing is screaming easy to use, but the reality for users is I'm confused and I have to call someone.
And you'd never see that just looking at the digital side.
Never. The offline data tells you that you need to optimize your media to address that confusion. The framework says you have to identify those insights and gaps across the entire ecosystem.
That makes a lot of sense. It stops you from optimizing for a metric that doesn't actually help the business.
Exactly.
So moving on, the source also talks about the audience. But it's not just, know your demographic. It specifically says you need to identify tools and technologies accessed by customers.
This is a really important technical competency. It's basically asking, do you know the tech stack of your end user?
Give me an example of why that matters. I mean, if I know they're on mobile, isn't that enough?
Not anymore. Mobile is way too broad. Are they accessing your content through, say, a native app or a mobile browser? Are they behind a corporate firewall that blocks certain video players? I've seen entire campaigns fail because the deliverable was this beautiful, high bandwidth interactive experience, but the target audience was mostly trying to access it on older Android devices with really spotty data connections.
So the tool they were using literally couldn't handle the deliverable.
Precisely. This standard requires you to map all of that out before you even start to build. You have to know the constraints.
And once you know the constraints, you have to predict behavior. The text says, establish audience engagement characteristics, expectations, and responses.
That sounds a little bit like fortune telling.
It does, a little bit.
How do you establish a response before you've even done anything?
You're establishing a baseline hypothesis. It's about knowing the sort of contract you have with that specific
The
audience.
contract.
Yeah, the unspoken contract. If you're on LinkedIn, the engagement characteristic is professional, maybe a little self-promotional, very text-heavy.
Sure.
If you post a meme there, the expectation is violated. But if you're on TikTok, the expectation is authenticity and speed. So you're basically predicting, if we do X, then our audience should do Y.
Yes. And that prediction is so crucial because it gives you something to measure against later on. If you predicted they would share the content, but they only liked it, you can ask why that happened. If you didn't establish that expectation up front, you can't analyze the deviation later.
Okay, so we've done the heavy lifting on prep. We have our objectives. We've analyzed the cross-channel data. Mm. We know our audience's tech stack. Now we can move to phase two, the build.
Right. Support optimization of digital media.
This is execution time.
Mm-hmm.
The standard uses the word deliverable a lot here. Use technology to create a deliverable. But then it throws in this requirement. Develop strategies for rapid real-time response.
This is one of my favorite parts of the framework, actually. It acknowledges just how volatile the medium is.
It sounds a bit like crisis management.
It is, but it's also opportunity management. Real-time response doesn't just mean what do we do if everyone hates this? It also means what do we do if this thing blows up in a good way?
But practically, how do you develop a strategy for something that hasn't happened?
You build decision trees. Let's say you're launching a campaign for a new sneaker. You need a pre-agreed protocol.
Okay.
So if a major influencer retweets us, do we engage? Who has the sign-off to apply to them? Do we have a bit of budget set aside to instantly boost that specific post?
I see. So you're not scrambling for approval at 8 p.m. on a Friday night.
Exactly. The strategy for rapid response is all about removing friction before the EMA happens. If you have to call a meeting to decide how to respond to a viral comment, you've already lost all the momentum.
That makes sense. The framework demands you have that agility baked in from the start.
Right.
And that ties into the next point. Model channel interaction options.
Hmm.
I felt like the text was a little vague here. It sounds good modeling options, but what does a professional actually do to satisfy this?
You can think of it as user flow mapping. You don't just, you know, post a link. You model the entire journey.
Walk me through that.
Okay, so you're promoting a white paper. Option A is a direct download link on Twitter.
Simple enough.
Option B is a thread that leads to a landing page. Modeling the interaction means you walk through every step. In option A, the user clicks, the PDF opens. Great. But how do we retarget them?
You can't.
You can't. In option B, they hit the landing page, the pixel fires, we capture their email, then they get the PDF.
So you're simulating the outcomes of these different architectural choices.
Yes. You're weighing the friction of an extra click against the value of the data you're going to capture. That's modeling channel interaction. You do it on a whiteboard before you even build the assets.
And then comes the reality check. Test interaction with target groups.
The sandbox phase.
But here's the kicker for me. The source explicitly says, adapt deliverable according to test outcomes, and also verify with relevant personnel.
That verify step is so important. It's the safety valve.
Is it? It sounds a bit like bureaucracy to me. If the test data says change the headline to red, why do I need to go verify that with someone? Just do it.
Because data lacks context. Let's say your A-B test shows that a super aggressive clickbaity headline gets 20% more clicks. The data just says, do it.
Right. More clicks.
But if you verify that with your brand director, the relevant personnel, they might point out that, hey, that headline totally violates our company's tone of voice, and it risks long-term brand equity. See, the optimization framework isn't just about maximizing a number. It's about maximizing that number within the constraints of the organization.
So the relevant personnel are basically guardrails.
Exactly. They stop you from optimizing yourself right off a cliff.
Speaking of guardrails, there's a very specific evidence requirement here I want to drill into. The two media rule. The standard says you must prove you can create and optimize at least two different digital media.
This one's all about cognitive versatility.
Why does that matter, though? If I'm an Instagram genius, why do I need to prove I can also optimize an email campaign or a blog post?
Because the mechanics of optimization are completely different for each one. Optimizing text, like a blog post, is about SEO, keywords, readability, structure, dwell time. It's a very linear, logical process.
Okay, and what about video or an image?
Optimizing a video is totally different. It's emotional, it's temporal. You're looking at drop-off rates, you're looking at visual hooks in the first 3 seconds, pacing, audio clarity. It uses a different part of your brain.
So the framework is basically saying a true professional isn't just a platform specialist. They understand the principles of optimization, which they can then apply to text, video, audio, whatever.
Correct. If you can only do one, you're a technician.
Yeah.
If you can do both, you're a strategist. You know how to adapt the message to the medium.
Okay, let's move to the final phase. We've prepped, we've built, we've modeled, and tested. Now, phase three, the scorecard. Evaluate digital media use.
The moment of truth.
The source lists the usual suspects for measurement: customer engagement, conversations, and conversions. I think most of our listeners know what those are. But then it throws a curveball. It asks us to moderate data to identify exceptions from agreed performance.
Moderate is such a polite word for what is essentially cleaning up the mess.
What kind of mess are we talking about here?
Data is never clean, ever. If you look at your conversion report and see a massive spike on a Tuesday, an amateur goes, wow, Tuesday was great.
Right.
A professional moderates the data. They dig in.
And what do they find when they dig in?
Maybe they find that 90% of that traffic came from a single IP address, which was your own dev team testing the site. Or maybe it was bot traffic.
Yeah.
Or a tracking pixel fired twice.
So moderating really means filtering out the noise to find the actual signal.
Yes. And specifically, the standard asks you to look for the exceptions. This is so critical. You're not just reporting the average, you are reporting the anomalies.
Why focus on the anomalies?
Because the average hides all the insight. If your campaign conversion rate is 2%, that's boring. But if one specific ad variation had a 0.5% rate and another had a 6% rate, those are the exceptions. The agreed performance was 2%. So why did one fail so badly and one soar?
That's where the learning happens.
It's the only place the learning happens. If you just report the aggregate numbers, you aren't optimizing. You're just, you know, accounting.
And that leads perfectly to the final step in the process. Document issues and recommendations.
Institutional memory.
It feels a little bit like paperwork, though. Write down what happened.
It is paperwork, but it's the difference between a project and a process. If you don't document that the red button outperformed the blue button, I guarantee you, 6 months from now, a new designer will come in and use the blue button again.
And you'll waste money relearning the exact same lesson.
Exactly. Documentation is really an investment in future speed. You start the next project 10 steps ahead because you already know what worked last time.
Now, to pull all of this off, the modeling, the moderation, the strategy, you need a toolkit.
Mm-hmm.
The source has a section on knowledge and skills.
The toolbox, yeah.
It mentions things like visualizations and dashboards. Again, pretty standard. But then it drops this phrase, nodes of integration across multiple digital environments.
Nodes of integration. It sounds incredibly complex, doesn't it?
It sounds like sci-fi. But in practice, this is just the plumbing of the internet, isn't it?
It is. A node is just the point where two systems shake hands.
Gives a concrete example.
Okay. You have a Facebook lead ad, that's environment A. You have your CRM, maybe Salesforce, that's environment B. The node of integration is the API connection that sends the name and email from Facebook over to Salesforce.
Simple enough.
Theoretically. But what if that node fails? What if the data format in Facebook doesn't match the field in Salesforce? What if the connection just times out?
Then you have a lead that you paid for, but your sales team never actually calls them.
Exactly. And your data moderation will be wrong because Salesforce will show zero leads, but Facebook will show 50. Understanding these nodes, where the pipes connect, and more importantly, where they leak, is a non-negotiable skill.
So you don't need to be a coder. Necessarily, but you need to understand data flow.
You need to know enough to know where to start looking when the numbers don't add up.
And the final piece of knowledge the source requires is industry-level performance metrics.
Context. It's always about context.
This effectively answers the question, so, is this good?
Right. You walk into a meeting and say, we have a 20% open rate on our email. Is that good? If you're in, say, the hobbyist niche, maybe that's average.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in the insurance industry, it might be phenomenal.
You can't evaluate your own performance in a vacuum.
Not at all. You need those industry benchmarks to know if you're overperforming or, you know, underperforming.
So let's pull this all together. We've gone through the whole document, and it's clear this is a loop.
A continuous loop, absolutely.
Let's imagine one of you listening is about to launch a project. Maybe it's a podcast. Maybe a new product line. Based on this framework, the story really should go like this.
Step one, preparation. You set the objective, you check the offline realities, and you map the user's tech.
Step two, build and optimize. You model the flow. You don't just guess. You create the assets, at least two different types.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a plan for when things go right or wrong in real time.
And step three, evaluate. You measure the result, you scrub the data for errors, find those weird exceptions, and then you write it all down so you don't make the same mistake twice.
It's a lot more work than just posting and praying.
It is. But that's why it's a professional standard. It's what turns luck into engineering.
I want to end with one specific thought from the source that really stuck with me. We touched on it briefly, but I think it's worth underscoring. It's the concept of identifying variation between target and actual performance.
The gap analysis?
It feels like the most vulnerable part of the whole job.
It is. It requires a lot of professional courage.
Explain that. Why courage?
Because in any corporate environment, the temptation is always to move the goalposts. If you targeted, say, 100 conversions and you only got 80, the instinct is to say, well, the market was tough. Or actually, 80 is pretty good historically.
Right, you spin the narrative.
This framework says, no, stop the spin. Just look at the gap. The gap is 20. Why is it 20? Was the creative bad? Was the targeting wrong? Was the product too expensive?
If you hide the gap, you hide the solution.
Exactly. You have to be brave enough to look at the actual number, stand it right next to the target number, and have a really honest conversation about the space in between.
That's a powerful place to leave it. The difference between an amateur and a pro isn't just skill, it's the honesty to look at where you missed the mark.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
Well, thank you for unpacking this this very dry document with me. It turns out the blueprint for success is usually hiding in the boring details.
It usually is.
For everyone listening, take a look at your current project. Find that node of integration, find that gap in your data, and start optimizing. We'll see you in the next deep dive.